When she asked whom the announcement might name, she wrote, Kennedy didn't hesitate. Looking straight ahead, he said, At this time I'm thinking about... Another more moderate Southerner, the young governor of North Carolina, Terry Sanford. But it will not be Lyndon, he said. Mrs. Lincoln says she wrote down the conversation verbatim in my diary, but before her book, Kennedy and Johnson, was published in 1968, at a point at which, it should perhaps be mentioned, Robert Kennedy was hoping for Johnson's support in his campaign for the presidency, Schlesinger saw an advance copy and, he says, alerted Robert Kennedy, who reiterated that there had been no intention of dumping Johnson, and added, Can you imagine the president ever having a talk with Evelyn about a subject like that? The reaction of the Kennedy partisans to her book is a case study in reversal. Prior to its publication, references to Mrs. Lincoln in their books and oral history reminiscences had all emphasized the respect Jack Kennedy had for her. In 11 years he never called her Evelyn, Sorensen wrote, and her faithfulness to the president. Soft-hearted is an adjective used about her by Sorensen, who calls her unruffled and devoted, and praises her unfailing devotion and good nature. Schlesinger talks of her welcoming patience and warmth with people insistent on seeing the president. When decades later the author asked these same partisans about this woman, whom President Kennedy had regarded highly enough so that he kept her as his private secretary for 11 years, she was described to the author by these same men as a flighty, rather rattle-brained woman. Following the publication of her book, the terms they used to describe the conversation she claims to have had with Kennedy about the 1964 ticket are skeptical. She claimed to remember the conversation, Schlesinger said. When the author of this book went to see her himself, she repeated the conversation as she had written it, saying that the president wanted Johnson off the ticket, and the ammunition to get him off was Bobby Baker. And for Lyndon Johnson, the stories were beginning to come closer and closer. Hitherto, during the 2 months in which the scandal had been unfolding, it had, despite the frequent mentions of Johnson's name, been primarily a scandal about Bobby Baker, but that was about to change. On November 15th, two liberal Democratic senators, Stephen M. Young of Ohio and Quentin M. Burdick of North Dakota, called in reporters and told them that in early January 1961, while Johnson was still contemplating keeping control of the Senate, Baker had kept them from seats on the Judiciary Committee by telling the Democratic Steering Committee, falsely, that neither had any interest in serving on the committee. Two Johnson allies, his junior senator from Texas, William A. Blakely, and Edward V. Long of Missouri, were named instead. And on November 18th, the New York Daily News columnist drew the lesson that the two senators' disclosures were not about Baker's personal financial maneuvers, but about his impact on the governmental process, that he had been an instrument of the Senate's inner circle, and specifically of Lyndon Johnson. As Baker was Johnson's errand boy, would he have given the steering committee the wrong information all by himself? And in the Daily News, perhaps for the first time in print, appeared the suggestion that the witnesses summoned to testify should include not only the instrument, but the man who, the Daily News said, had wielded it, the man who was now Vice President of the United States. If Baker is to be quizzed by the investigating Senate Rules Committee about this specific incident, it would appear only fair to have the Vice President called to give his version. On that same day, November 18th, the Monday of the week the President was to leave for Texas, a new Life article hit the newsstands. Its headline was still, The Bobby Baker Case, Scandal Grows and Grows in Washington. And the text, written by Keith Wheeler and based on the work of a 9-member Life investigative team, was in part merely a recounting of Baker's personal financial saga that had been public since the filing of the Serview suit, and of the role of sex in his rise to wealth. In the peculiar Washington world here under review, wives were not the only women included in social activity. One way or another, young women become more or less legal tender in the ancient and crafty commerce of getting things done, although it added, in chop-slicking prose, some new details. One of the Quorum Club hostesses kept a tambourine and harem pants handy, as costume for the Oriental dances she sometimes performed. Sometimes she did other dances which required no costume whatever. During one exercise in which a number of naked young women poured champagne over each other in a bathtub, Ellie Romich was bitten in the behind by another bather, but apparently bore her wound with fortitude and no ill will, and was illustrated by a new photograph of Carol Tyler, no longer a blonde but a brunette, who had posed graciously for life's cameras, not in the surf but on a sofa in a demure suit. But the article was also about the Senate, and about Lyndon Johnson. The Senate had been Baker's base of operations, Wheeler explained, and the Senate was controlled rigidly by a small group that was its establishment. And, in a very real sense, the establishment is the personal creation of Lyndon Baines Johnson, who, from the day he took over as majority leader until he went to the vice presidency, ruled it like an absolute monarch. It was Johnson who sponsored Bobby Baker's election as majority secretary and fashioned him into his legman, mouthpiece, and satrap of power. And the article demonstrated that Johnson had used Baker in that way at the beginning of his vice presidency as well. Quentin Burdick had been independent, Life said, quoting, a man in a position to know, and Lyndon Johnson wasn't likely to forgive that. So Bobby Baker shivved Burdick. It was typical. The article gave examples of Baker's use of campaign funds, how he gave Paul Douglas only $3,000 of the $12,000 that had been donated for him, and an example of how, as Wheeler put it, such campaign money might carry its own corrupting price tag. In 1958, when Frank Edward Moss was running for the Senate in Utah, an emissary was dispatched from Washington to offer him a big chunk of money to boost his campaign along. But then the messenger let him know there was a catch. He could have the swag only in return for his signature and a letter avowing that he had studied the 27.5% oil depletion allowance and concluded that its continuance was in the national interest. And the article disclosed, in addition, that much of the campaign funding was in cash. When there was a lot of it, somebody, not necessarily Baker, but somebody in the entourage, carried it in a money belt strapped around his belly. But the article also made it clear that it wasn't Baker who had directed the collection and distribution of the money. He had done so, the article explained, in his post as Secretary of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. It was a committee in name only, for Johnson controlled it absolutely, Life said. And money was given only to senators and senatorial candidates whom Johnson felt he could control. In the words of a Senate insider quoted by the magazine, what Lyndon wanted was a nice, cozy little majority with no backtalk, no mavericks. Bobby Baker, this source said, had simply been Lyndon's bluntest instrument in running the show. Famous though Bobby might have become, he was no more than Lyndon's acolyte. He always spoke of LBJ as the leader. He even tried to be Johnson. He copied Johnson's clothes and mannerisms. When he came into the Senate chamber, he'd take the Johnson stance. After the publication of that article, in that immensely influential magazine, it was clear that the Bobby Baker case was inevitably going to become the Lyndon Johnson case as well. For someone who was poring over every word in the Life article, as Lyndon Johnson was poring over every word, one of those words in it was, according to George Reedy, particularly distressing. Baker's new home, it said, was near millionaire Lyndon Johnson's home. Millionaire. This was perhaps the first time that Johnson had ever been identified as such in print, at least in a national publication. He had perhaps never been identified in a national publication even as a wealthy man, let alone a very wealthy man. For Life to do so, it must know something about his personal fortune that he had previously been able to keep hidden. And, in fact, it did. The magazine's investigative team had been working since the end of October, and during that time, says its leader, Associate Editor William Lambert, I began to pick up all these hints about Lyndon Johnson, not merely about Johnson and his relationship with the newly rich Bobby Baker, but about Lyndon Johnson and the acquisition of his fortune. Following up on the hints, the team had found, in the words of Russell Sackett, one of its members and also an associate editor, that The deeper you got, the more serious they were. He was far richer than anyone had expected. But he was, in fact, very rich indeed. "I was very indignant," Lambert said, and during the week of November 11th he had gone to the office of George P. Hunt, Life's managing editor, and said of Lyndon Johnson, "This guy looks like a bandit to me." Although bandit is, of course, a synonym for robber or thief, Lambert didn't feel he was misusing the word. I felt that he had used public office to enhance his private wealth. He told Hunt, "We're going to have to spend some money to investigate. I need some people and a lot of time." "Johnson's entire financial picture should be looked into," he said. "It was almost a net worth job, and you know that takes an enormous amount of time." I told Hunt, "He's got a fortune, and he's been on the public payroll ever since he got out of college. And I don't know how he got it, but it's there." By the time he went in to see Hunt, Lambert was to recall, "We knew he was a millionaire many times over." After listening to Lambert's description of what the investigation had uncovered thus far, Hunt agreed to allocate the manpower Lambert wanted. The managing editor warned him to be very careful in checking the facts, because he, Johnson, is only a heartbeat away from the presidency, and, Lambert recalls, "We put together a kind of task force, and by the end of that week, no fewer than 9 reporters were digging, not only in Washington but in Austin and Johnson City, into a story which, if it was told in any detail, would be a story that was being told for the first time. What Sackett calls the story of Lyndon Johnson's money." By the middle of the week of November 18th, even while Wheeler's Bobby Baker story was still on the newsstands, the investigative team had uncovered enough new material so that, in Sackett's words, "We knew there was a much bigger story. We were finding more and more on Lyndon." Wheeler and Lambert felt Hunt should be informed about their findings, and a meeting in the managing editor's office, at which all the members of the team who were in New York would be present, was scheduled for the late morning of that Friday, November 22nd. And also on that Friday, for the first time, a Lyndon Johnson financial transaction was going to be described by a witness, seated beside his lawyer, to representatives of the United States Senate. For on November 22, 1963, the witness in a closed hearing with the staff of the Senate Rules Committee was going to be Don B. Reynolds. He began testifying that morning at 10 o'clock. Lyndon Johnson had flown to his ranch on Friday, November 15th. The president and Jackie were to spend the following Friday night, the 22nd, and Saturday at the ranch after the fundraising dinner in Austin. Kennedy wasn't looking forward to the visit. When O'Donnell and Dave Powers tried to get out of accompanying him, he told them they didn't have a chance. "You two guys aren't running out on me and leaving me stranded with poor Jackie at Lyndon's ranch. If I've got to hang around there all day Saturday wearing one of those big cowboy hats, you've got to be there too." But since he was going to be in his vice president's hometown, not visiting the ranch would have added to the speculation Kennedy was trying to avoid. The Johnsons had flown down a week ahead of time to prepare for the visit. Tight as were the political tensions, the Senate investigation, the Yarborough feud, that were wound around Lyndon Johnson that week, the visit, being social, gave the screw another twist. This was important to him to have this go off well, his secretary Marie Famer says. He was quite tense. Liz Carpenter recalls, "Much cleaning and directing of servants to have everything spick and span. Everything had to be perfect. When the president had been asked if there was anything he'd like to do at the ranch, he had said that perhaps he'd like to ride." This casual remark brought an influx of new horse flesh. Wesley West's thoroughbreds were the finest in the hill country. 8 of the best were brought to the Johnson Ranch. A Tennessee walking horse with its easy gait might be a good horse for Jackie. Lady Bird's Tennessee Walker was at that moment back in Tennessee, undergoing further training. A horse trailer was dispatched to get it back before the Kennedys arrived. Supplies of the president's preferred beverages, Poland water, Ballantine's, scotch, were laid in. Inquiries were made to determine the temperature, tepid, at which he liked to drink the water. Jackie sometimes preferred Newport cigarettes, sometimes Salem's. Adequate supplies of both were laid in. The champagnes she preferred had, of course, been purchased, but then it was learned that she sometimes liked to drink them over ice. Bess Abel was assigned to show one of the housemen, James Davis, "This is how you pour champagne on the rocks for Mrs. Kennedy." A trip to Austin produced new terry cloth hand towels for Jackie. Then it was learned that she preferred smooth hand towels. Another 120-mile round trip was made. Liz Carpenter recalls many telephone calls and drives into town to bring back the very nicest perfumes, scented soaps for Mrs. Kennedy's bathroom. And one thing wasn't perfect. The bedboard and horsehair mattress for the president's bad back hadn't arrived on schedule, and the empty bed seemed to loom over all the preparations. Mrs. Abell kept thinking, will he wander into Bear Springs? And there was one piece of information that it had proven impossible to determine. The duration of the Kennedys' visit. Would they be staying until Sunday? Repeated inquiries to the Kennedy staff had produced no response. As Friday neared, that was still very much a question mark, Mrs. Abell says. Then there was the question of entertainment. The ranch's specialty was a sheep-herding show in which two sheepdogs rounded up a small herd of sheep and moved them from one pen to another. It had been decided to stage that show for the Kennedys because it would, Ms. Carpenter says, give them a real flavor of the hillside of Texas, which Mrs. Johnson wanted very much to show them, but the decision was continually revisited. On one hand, writes one of Mrs. Johnson's biographers, Jane Jarbo Russell, she wanted to entertain Mrs. Kennedy in her own unpretentious way, out of doors, yet she was also eager to avoid playing the part of the rube. And Lady Bird had an additional concern, indeed horror. Because the paved path from the ranch airstrip led not to the front door of the ranch house, but to the kitchen door and back, she had fallen into the habit of bringing visitors into the house by that entrance, so that they entered through a little room containing a washing machine and dryer, and then came into the kitchen with its corkboard filled with scribbled messages, and she seemed unable to break herself of that habit. The image of Jackie Kennedy, immaculately dressed, being herded through the busy ranch kitchen seemed like a waking nightmare to Lady Bird, Russell writes. If you don't do anything else for me, please be sure that I get the President and Mrs. Kennedy into the living room door and not the kitchen door, she told Mrs. Abell. I'm sure to forget about it. The President was to land at San Antonio's Bergstrom Air Force Base at 1:30 on Thursday afternoon, November 21st, lead a motorcade through the city to the new Aerospace Medical Center, then fly on to Houston for another motorcade, and an Albert Thomas appreciation dinner in the Houston Coliseum that evening. After the dinner, he would fly to Fort Worth, where on Friday he would give a breakfast speech before flying to Dallas for another motorcade, which was scheduled to end at the Dallas Trade Mart, where he was to give a luncheon speech before flying down to Austin for the $100-a-plate dinner, and later that night to the LBJ Ranch. When on Thursday at 11:20 a.m. the Johnsons left the ranch in their Beechcraft Bonanza for the short flight to Bergstrom, where they would greet the President, they left behind them a staff still agonizing over details of the Kennedy visit. The President's arrival at Bergstrom brought with it more trouble for Lyndon Johnson, political trouble, but with a personal twist. Close behind the President and Jackie as they came down the steps of Air Force One was Ralph Yarborough, who, along with most of the 20-member Texas congressional delegation, had flown to Texas with the President. The senator, Ken O'Donnell was to say, had boarded the plane in a rage, having just learned that there was going to be no seat for him at the head table at the Austin dinner and no invitation at all for him to Connally's reception for the President at the governor's mansion. On the flight down, Ken O'Donnell says, his anger had boiled over when reporters asked his reaction. "I'm not surprised," he said. "Governor Connally is so uneducated governmentally, how could you expect anything else?" If his anger required additional fuel, it was provided by a group of supporters who, as he came down onto the Bergstrom tarmac, crowded around him to tell him, as one of them says, that what Connally and Johnson are trying to do to you was public knowledge. And as it happened, he did not have to wait more than a few minutes for an opportunity to retaliate for these slights, delivering one of his own that was particularly painful to a man who lived in dread of public humiliation. A motorcade was forming on the tarmac for the drive from the airport to the Aerospace Medical Center. Behind the lead police car was the long, midnight blue presidential convertible, carrying the Kennedys and Connellys, followed by the Secret Service security car, which reporters had dubbed the Queen Mary, an open armored 4-ton rolling arsenal with 4 agents inside and 4 more standing on the running boards, And then, after the requisite 75-foot security gap, the rented convertible for the vice president, and a rented car containing his Secret Service detail. And then a car for the 4-man press pool, a press bus for the 40 reporters not in the pool, a caravan of open cars crammed with still photographers and newsreel cameramen, and other convertibles for congressmen and local officials. Yarborough had been assigned by O'Donnell to ride with the Johnsons, but now he refused to do so. When the chief of Johnson's Secret Service detail, Special Agent Rufus Youngblood, a lanky, balding Georgian with an easy drawl, tried to direct the senator to Johnson's car, he simply ignored him. Turning to San Antonio Congressman Henry Gonzalez, he asked, "Henry, can I hitch a ride with you?" and got into his car instead. The motorcade pulled away on its 16-mile trip to the medical center, and hardly had it entered the streets of San Antonio when huge crowds were waiting for it, packed 4-deep on the sidewalks, jumping and screaming and shouting, "Jack! Jackie!" as it approached, with thousands of children released from school for the day waving little hand-colored American flags. In the presidential limousine, the Kennedys and Connollys, two handsome, poised men and their wives, Jackie radiant in a stylish suit, Nellie Connolly, once sweetheart of the university at the University of Texas, still beautiful at 44, basked in the adulation, smiling and waving at the crowds and chatting together. Behind them came a long line of open cars, jammed to the gunnels with congressmen and camaraderie. In one convertible, two congressmen sat in front with the driver, and 5 more were crammed in behind them, 3 sitting in the back seat and 2 on the top of the seat, with their legs hanging down into the car. And in the midst of this procession of smiling, waving men crowded happily together, was one car in which, in the wide back seat, too wide in the circumstances, the Johnsons' situation was awkward, said one account. No matter how wide they spread themselves, they were obviously missing a passenger. The Vice President of the United States sat alone with his wife, unaccompanied except for the driver and Youngblood in the front seat, because the man who had been assigned to ride with him had refused to do so. Alone and naked to the gaze of the reporters behind him, who knew he wasn't supposed to be alone, Ken O'Donnell had given them a list of the car assignments for the principals in the motorcade, and who knew why he was. When later a reporter asked Gonzalez what the day's main story should be, the congressman said it should be the tumultuous reception San Antonio had given the president. "No," the reporter said, "the headline was going to be, 'Yarborough refuses to ride with Lyndon Johnson.'" Johnson knew the reporters had been given the list. He knew that they knew why he was alone. The trip from Bergstrom to the medical center took a little more than an hour. It must have been a long hour for Lyndon Johnson. After Kennedy's speech at the medical center, there was another motorcade to the plains that would carry the party to Houston. Yarborough got back into Gonzalez's car again, and Rufus Youngblood got out of Johnson's and went back to the senator to ask him to ride with Johnson. With a curt wave of his hand, Yarborough had him go away. Returning to Johnson's convertible, Youngblood slid into the front seat, turned to Johnson and spread his hands in a helpless gesture, saying simply, "Well, I told him." The reporters were watching. Then there was Houston, another airport, with Johnson, whose plane had of course landed first, waiting at the foot of the ramp to welcome the Kennedys and Connollys and Yarborough, as if he was the state's official greeter, another motorcade through cheering crowds that weren't cheering for him, with him and his wife again conspicuously alone in their car. New attempts to persuade Yarborough to join him had been made by Congressman Thomas, the honoree of the evening's dinner, and by Youngblood. "I've begged him enough," the agent said when he came back to Johnson's car this time. And then, during a 3-hour rest stop at Houston's Rice Hotel before the dinner, Jack Kennedy asked Lyndon Johnson to come to his suite, and the door was shut behind them. And there were, perhaps for the first time since Kennedy had been elected, loud, angry words directly between the president and vice president. No one knew quite what those words were. Johnson was later to deny there had been any. There definitely was not a disagreement. There was an active discussion. He and the president had been in substantial agreement, he said. The hotel waiters who came in and out of the suite, interviewed later by the author William Manchester, told him, in his summation, that they heard Yarborough's name mentioned several times, and that they had received the impression that Kennedy felt the senator, Yarborough, was not being treated fairly, and that he, the president, was expressing himself with exceptional force. Jackie Kennedy, rehearsing her speech for that evening's dinner in the next room, heard raised voices but said only, "There was all of this talk about people not wanting to ride in the car with him." After Johnson had left, she asked her husband, "What was that all about? He sounded mad." "That's just Lyndon," her husband replied, seeming amused. "He's in trouble." On a later occasion, she said, "I remember asking Jack what the trouble was. He said that John Connolly wanted to show that he was independent and could run on his own, and he wanted to show that he didn't need Lyndon Johnson or something, and that part of the trouble of the trip was him, Connolly, trying to show that he had his own constituency." That day, Kennedy had asked Albert Thomas to intercede not just with Yarborough but with Connolly to bring the party-splitting feud to an end. And on the brief flight from San Antonio to Houston, Thomas had in fact asked Connolly to allow Yarborough a more prominent role at the Austin dinner. Thomas had had to report to Kennedy that Connolly had not been receptive. One of the purposes of the trip, to create the party unity Kennedy needed for his re-election campaign in a key state, was not being accomplished. The president may, behind that closed door at the Rice, have let his anger loose at the Texan he had put on his ticket but who was proving not to be a viable mediator at all. And Johnson may have responded that it was not his fault that Yarborough was still hostile, that Yarborough wouldn't even ride in his car. Whatever was said, when Johnson opened the closed door, nothing had been settled. Johnson came rushing out into the corridor with an angry expression on his face. "He left that suite like a pistol," one of the Secret Service agents on duty outside said. After the dinner, the president rode to the Houston airport with the Houston Chronicler's publisher, John T. Jones, Jr., and his wife, Winnie. Jones shared with the president the results of a Texas poll that would be published in his newspaper on Friday. It showed Yarborough's approval rating, 57%, above that for a Kennedy-Johnson ticket. "He's in trouble," Kennedy had said about Johnson, and whatever the president had meant when he said it, that poll, which of course reinforced the other Texas polls he had seen, indeed meant trouble for Johnson. He had been supposed to be holding together the conservative and liberal wings of the Texas Democratic Party. The conservative leader, Connolly, had been trying to demonstrate to Kennedy that he didn't need Johnson, and the demonstration had been convincing. The liberal leader, Yarborough, didn't need Johnson, didn't want him, wouldn't even ride in a car with him. And both Connolly and Yarborough were running well ahead of the Kennedy-Johnson ticket. They didn't need Kennedy nearly as much as he needed them. Not only might his vice president no longer be a viable mediator in the feud, he was beginning to seem, in a way, almost irrelevant. Chapter 18. The Southern Strategy. Then he had to turn back to Capitol Hill, to Congress. Much of Lyndon Johnson's accomplishment thus far in his presidency, creating an impression of continuity by holding the Kennedy men, and of competence by his first speech, had been, while important, symbolic in nature. Dealing with Congress wouldn't be symbol but substance, indispensable substance, the very essence of governing in a democracy, for in dealing with Congress a president was dealing with a democracy's very heart, the creation of the laws by which it was governed. The creation of the laws most needed if America were to fulfill the ideals on which it had been founded had proven to be very difficult for presidents for a very long time. The stalemate between the White House and Capitol Hill had begun not a few years, but a quarter of a century before, not under JFK, but FDR, because it was Franklin Roosevelt who, in 1937, exuberant over his landslide re-election and with unprecedented Democratic majorities in Congress, 76 of the 96 senators, a 56-seat plurality in the House, had attempted to pack the Supreme Court, and in a titanic struggle with the Senate had been defeated. The defeat had repercussions beyond the court, for almost a century before Roosevelt, The Senate, with its unbreakable filibuster and its six-year terms, staggered, moreover, so that public opinion could never touch more than one-third of the body at any one election. It stood like a mighty dam, towering and impregnable against social reform legislation, no matter how strong the tide of public opinion the legislation might have behind it. During the first term of his presidency, not just during its first 100 days, but during the almost 4 years thereafter, Roosevelt had broken through the dam, stripping Congress of its power. The court-packing proposal had brought together in opposition Republicans and conservative Democratic senators, particularly from southern and border states, and Roosevelt had thereby inadvertently handed the Senate back its power. For 4 years, uneasy though those senators had been over the New Deal's agenda of social reform, they had been awed by Roosevelt's seemingly unchallengeable popularity into going along with it. Their victory over the president on court packing reminded Republicans and conservative Democrats of their strength if they stayed together, and made them realize also the similarity in their philosophies, uniting them against the New Deal, as an historian has written, in a way they would have been completely incapable of achieving on their own. Powerful in both houses of Congress, the new coalition was virtually invulnerable in the Senate, as Johnson had reminded his troika. Roosevelt's 1938 purge campaign against Southern Democratic senators had resulted in nothing but defeats for the president. Year by year thereafter, for a quarter of a century, the power of the Southern Democrats grew. Congress gave Roosevelt a free hand in running the Second World War in domestic affairs. On the other hand, he never got a single major social reform bill through Congress during the 8 years of his presidency remaining after the court fight. This discussion of presidential-congressional relations is adapted, sometimes with direct quotes, from Master of the Senate. The fair deal fared little better. Harry Truman's program was a far-reaching attempt to alleviate social and economic injustices in a nation which, rich though it was, had left most of its citizens unprotected against the ravages of old age and unemployment. A nation in which an inexcusably high percentage of the population, not Roosevelt's one-third of a nation perhaps, but not much less, was still ill-fed, ill-clothed, and ill-housed. A nation which denied to millions of its citizens, those whose skin was black, the most fundamental rights of citizens. After Capitol Hill gave Truman almost nothing of what he asked during the 3.5 years in which he was filling out Roosevelt's term, and he made the Do-Nothing Congress the issue in the 1948 election campaign and won a stunning victory in his own right, the new Democratic majority in Congress and a rising public outcry against Jim Crow gave liberals confidence that the long-awaited day of social justice was at last at hand. It wasn't. The election had changed nothing in the South. Every Southern senator who was up for re-election had won. In both House and Senate, key committee chairmanships, with their immense all but unchallengeable authority, would still be held by Southerners. The Southern Democrat-Republican coalition was actually stronger than ever. The frustrated liberal Senator Paul Douglas was to write of how it flaunted its power. As when Harry F. Byrd and Republican leader Robert A. Taft sat together on the floor, checking the list of senators and sending out for the absent, or laying down the law to the few recalcitrants. When Truman left office 4 years later, his only victories in civil rights had been the limited ones, most notably desegregation of the armed forces, that he had obtained by executive orders, which did not require Capitol Hill's assent. As for the rest of his program, Congress had given him only a patch on the nation's needs. His proposals for national health insurance, for expanded unemployment insurance, for reduced taxes for the poor, for the expansion of federal aid to education, every one of those proposals died on Capitol Hill. And even those few victories which Congress allowed him, a meager increase in the minimum wage, a small expansion of Social Security, would, thanks to Congress, prove even less meaningful than they had first appeared. Housing was an example. In 1949, more than 10 million American families were still living in houses and apartments that didn't meet even the lowest standards for decent housing. Congress grudgingly enacted legislation authorizing construction of 800,000 housing units, far fewer than Truman had asked for. But it didn't appropriate funds for the 800,000 units in 1949 or during the rest of his term. The appropriation bills Congress passed were in fact so small that by 1955, 6 years later, only 300,000 units had been built, not even enough to keep up with the increase in population. The number of Americans living in substandard housing was still over 10 million. As for the minimum wage, one increase, Congress had apparently decided, was plenty. In 1955, it still stood at a pathetically inadequate 75 cents an hour. During 2 years of Truman's term, the Senate was controlled by Republicans, but the identity of the party in power didn't matter. It was the Southern Conservative Coalition that mattered, and the Southern Conservative Coalition held firm. Bills that passed the House dashed themselves against the Senate dam and died. When, during the 1950s, the dam's gates swung briefly open at last, it wasn't the president, Dwight Eisenhower, who forced them open. The bolts were pulled back from within by Lyndon Johnson, who, as Senate Majority Leader from 1955 through 1960, not only won an increase in the minimum wage. The brilliant legislative maneuvers by which Johnson won the minimum wage increase are described in Master of the Senate, pages 609 to 612, but extended its coverage to millions of workers who hadn't been earning even that minimum, broke the housing impasse by raising appropriations to a level that would realize the goal set in the 1949 bill, and even accomplished what seemed impossible to accomplish, passage by the Senate of the first civil rights bill since Reconstruction. No sooner had Johnson left the majority leader's desk than the gates swung shut again, more firmly than ever. While the stalemate hadn't begun under Kennedy, it had grown worse under Kennedy. The sure touch the young president demonstrated on foreign affairs, a sure touch amounting to diplomatic genius in the Cuban Missile Crisis, the programs, the Peace Corps, the Alliance for Progress, the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, which embodied an idealism that was the best of America, the mastery he showed on the podium and in press conferences, the ability he displayed there to inspire a nation and rally it to its better, most humane impulses, did not, during the 3 years of his presidency that was all he was allowed, carry over to the implementation of those ideals in domestic reforms, did not integrate into American life the ideals he so movingly enunciated. In 1961, and again in 1962, he had sent Congress health care reform legislation, including, most importantly, a proposal, Medicare, for health care insurance for the elderly. The House Ways and Means Committee had not agreed until November 1963 even to hold hearings on that proposal. In 1961 and again in 1962, he had sent Congress education legislation to provide federal aid for college loans for students who otherwise couldn't afford college, for vocational training and for urgently needed classroom construction for elementary and secondary schools and colleges. The construction bills had finally passed the House and Senate in November, but in versions so different that it appeared likely that any version which reported out, if in fact any version was reported out, by the conference committee would fail of passage. The other education proposals were stalled completely. The few successes he had enjoyed in Congress, manpower training legislation, a farm bill, increases in Social Security benefits and the minimum wage, were exceptions and relatively minor ones. In 1961, Congress had passed his Area Redevelopment Program to provide aid for depressed areas. The program had been hailed as a major achievement. In 1963, Congress was asked to authorize funds that would enable the program to continue. It declined to do so. And his record on other legislation was even bleaker. Bills to create a youth conservation corps and other programs to combat juvenile delinquency, to create a cabinet-level Department of Urban Affairs, to provide funds for urban mass transit, to preserve natural resources, not one of these had been passed. Civil rights was only one of the logs caught in the jam. The bill that, along with civil rights, he considered most important, the tax cut bill that, saying nothing should stand in its way, he had sent to Capitol Hill in January, was still lodged in Harry Byrd's Senate Finance Committee, with endless amendments still to be disposed of, and even a committee quorum apparently difficult to obtain. Of his major domestic legislative proposals, Medicare, federal aid to education, the tax cuts, civil rights, nearly 3 years into the administration of John F. Kennedy, not one had become law. Nor, in November 1963, had his request for $4.5 billion in foreign aid been passed. It had already been whittled down to $3.6 billion by the Senate, and the House was just waiting to get its hands on the measure and reduce it further. When Lyndon Johnson became president, the deadlock in Congress that the press called a logjam had, except for its breakup during his majority leadership, lasted for 26 years. During 1963, it wasn't merely major legislation that had become caught in the jam. Appropriations bills, too, weren't moving normally through the congressional machinery. Hadn't been moving normally for months. Each year, 12 appropriations measures had to be passed to pay the operating expenses of the government's departments and agencies. For under the Constitution, no government agency can spend any federal money unless it has been appropriated by Congress. Although these bills were nothing more than routine housekeeping measures that simply provided the funds necessary to carry out decisions already made by Congress to appropriate, for example, money for public works projects like dams, reclamation projects that Congress had already authorized. Traditional congressional inefficiency had often kept a few appropriations bills for each fiscal year. The government's fiscal year begins in the middle of the calendar year on July 1st, so the current bills were to pay expenses for the period July 1st, 1963 through June 30th, 1964, from being passed until late in each congressional session, sometimes at the very last minute before adjournment. Never, however, had so many of them not been passed this late. The 12 bills sent to Capitol Hill by the White House early in the year had been referred to each chamber's appropriations committees. 4 had been passed by both houses, but in different forms, and although there seemed to be no major points at issue, were tied up in conference committees. 4 had been passed by the House, but not by the Senate. As a result, with 8 bills not passed, 8 departments had been limping along for months under continuing resolutions, renewed and then re-renewed every month or so, which allowed them only to proceed with projects and programs already underway, but not to undertake any new ones, and which required them to hold their overall spending to the level of the previous fiscal year and not spend at the higher levels that would have been authorized under Kennedy's proposed more liberal 1964 fiscal year appropriations. For almost half of 1963, July 1st through November, therefore, spending had been held to the previous year's level, and no new projects, not even ones that had been authorized by Congress, had begun. The delay had already given conservatives a solid, measurable victory by the measure that counted with them, a reduction in government spending, a lessening of the impact of the government they mistrusted. So long had the appropriations bills been delayed that even were they to be approved now, the 8 departments would not have time to spend the money authorized in them. Some $2 billion that would have been spent was, in effect, lost forever. "The longer these bills are delayed, the less of a drain on the Treasury," explained the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, Clarence Cannon of Missouri. What was happening in 1963 had gone beyond the traditional. Never in history had so much of the federal government remained unfunded so late in the year. The general slowdown on Capitol Hill had also reached new levels, observers said. "This Congress has gone further than any other within memory to replace debate and decision by delay and stultification," Walter Lippmann wrote. Calling Congress a scandal of drift and inefficiency, Life pointed out that it has sat longer than any peacetime Congress in memory without producing needed legislation. "The least productive Congress in memory," William Shannon called it. And there was no sign of the deadlock being broken. Education, health insurance, foreign aid, tax cuts, civil rights bills, everything seemed stalled completely on Capitol Hill. Although a few longtime congressional observers had, during the very last days of the Kennedy administration, begun to glimpse a pattern, a strategy behind the delays in congressional, particularly senatorial, action on a wide variety of legislation, the explanations offered by most Washington commentators and by senators like Dodd and Clark still focused on the familiar villains. Congressional inefficiency caused by absenteeism, archaic rules, a seniority system which left the committee chairmanships in the hands of elderly men, or lack of leadership. If there was a unifying strategy behind the various delays, very few people were aware of it. But Lyndon Johnson, surveying the Capitol Hill battlefield for the first time as president, appears to have seen the pattern and recognized it at a glance, as was understandable. Since it was a strategy that during his very first months in the Senate 14 years before, he had helped carry out. Public outcry for civil rights, for an end to Jim Crow, had been rising in 1949, too, in the wake of Truman's dramatic 1948 campaign, in which he had committed himself to that cause, and the Democratic recapture of Congress, which brought outspoken civil rights advocates like Paul Douglas and Hubert Humphrey to the Senate. Believers in social justice were confident that the Southern caucus would no longer be able to stand in its way. Expressing a viewpoint found in many liberal journals after the election, the columnist Thomas L. Stokes wrote that the president can get most of his program and without so much compromise if he constantly calls upon the great public support manifest for him in this election. Richard Russell's public stance was an admission that the odds against the South were long. "It is clear that the only thing we can do now is gird our loins and shout the cry of centuries. The enemy comes to our tents, O Israel," he said. Behind the Senate scenes, however, he wasn't bewailing the odds, but shortening them. For a more detailed discussion of Russell's 1949 victory over civil rights, see Master of the Senate, pages 215 to 218, from which this summary is adapted. He drew up a list of all federal laws that would expire during 1949 if they were not renewed by Congress, to see, he quietly explained to his troops, if there are any of them that will build up a logjam behind the civil rights bills, and found one in particular that the administration could not afford to have delayed. Unless Congress extended federal rent control laws, the only protection against exorbitant rents for millions of families in northern cities, they would expire on March 31st, and then he simply delayed the progress of the bills that would have extended rent control and the other expiring laws by having them held in Senate committees controlled by Southerners or delayed at some other point in the Senate process. While on the floor, his Southern senators conducted a filibuster, not on the civil rights bill itself, but on the motion to bring the civil rights bill to the floor. Should the South lose that battle, should cloture be imposed to end the filibuster on the motion, he would still have another line of defense, a filibuster against the bill itself, to fall back on. Falling back, however, would not be necessary. As February became March in 1949, editorialists thundered against the filibuster and public demand for cloture rose, but somehow the votes for cloture were never there, and the focus was shifting to the bills that were soon to expire. And the Senate Majority Leader, Scott Lucas, calling the logjam in Senate business intolerable, warned that rent control would go out the window if civil rights was not withdrawn from the floor. Withdrawal would be surrender. The only senators who could withdraw the bill were the liberals who had introduced it. But many of the constituents of these senators lived in northern cities. If they didn't withdraw civil rights, and rent control therefore expired, their constituents would be the ones who were hurt. The bill was withdrawn. The South had won again. The Southern senators knew who deserved the credit. With less than 25% of the membership of the Senate, the Southerners have won one of the most notable victories in our history, Harry Byrd said. The credit goes mainly, of course, to our great leader, Dick Russell. I do not think that even Robert E. Lee, the newly elected Lyndon Johnson, had been one of the senators who in 1949 sat around the oval table in Richard Russell's office as that strategy was laid out, one of the soldiers who carried it out, one of the Southern sentries stationed in relays on the Senate floor to see, in Russell's instructions, that no legislative trickery is employed to secure the passage of any of these bills. Relative to my guard duty, I will do my best, Johnson assured him. One of the speakers in the filibuster, the deliverer on behalf of We of the South, of a major 35-page speech defending the right of unlimited debate that Russell called one of the ablest I've ever heard on the subject, and that moved Southern senators to line up at Johnson's desk to congratulate this fresh recruit to their cause. Recognizing the strategy to defeat a civil rights bill by holding other bills hostage until, to secure their release, the White House or liberal senators agreed to withdraw it, Johnson recognized something else, that if something were not done to counteract it, the strategy would succeed now as it had succeeded not only in 1949 but at several other times in the past, because it enlisted on the side of Russell's embattled Southern minority in the Senate a reliable ally. Time. Time had not been on the side of the great general to whom Russell was continually being compared. When Lee, on the defensive in 1865, as Russell was on the defensive now, was desperately improvising one maneuver after another as Grant pressed him back and back, he had known in his heart that each stratagem was merely a delaying action that might postpone but could not avert defeat. Time was on Russell's side, however. His battlefield was both sides of Capitol Hill. Southern strategy in Senate and House was coordinated. Explains Strom Thurmond's administrative assistant Harry Dent, no one had had to say anything. They, Southern representatives and Southern senators, had been doing it so long. Things were understood without any words having to be spoken. But the Senate, with its filibusters, was the last redoubt. And in the Senate, time, the use of time, the use of delay while the days of the calendar drifted away, could, if enlisted on the side of a cause, mean victory, even if majority opinion among the American people and majority opinion in the Senate itself, factors which in theory meant victory in a democracy, were united on the other side. For Lee, there had been no time limit to the war, no point at which, if he could delay Grant until then, hold out until then, a final armistice would be declared so that the South would not lose. But in Congress, in the Senate that was Russell's final redoubt, there was always a time limit, always a deadline, always a point at which time would run out for supporters of civil rights if he could just hold out until then. The end of each two-year Congress. A bill that has not been passed at the end of a Congress dies and must start over from scratch in the next Congress. Must be reintroduced, must negotiate again all the preliminary procedures in both houses, must be passed again by both houses. The effectiveness of the legendary Senate rules and precedents as traps in which year after year, decade after decade, hopes for social justice were ensnared and died, was in many crucial aspects a function not only of the gavel but of the clock and the calendar. So long as a civil rights bill remained on the Senate floor, so long as the Southerners were filibustering it to prevent it from coming to a vote, they could prevent any other bill from being brought to the floor. Not a White House bill essential to an administration's program, not a bill essential to an individual senator's political survival, for example, a bill he needed to get passed to satisfy his constituents, bills to authorize a public works project perhaps, or if the project had already been authorized, to have funds appropriated for its construction in one of the 12 appropriations bills. So long as civil rights remained on the floor, these bills would be held where they were, held hostage, imprisoned in committee or on the calendar, until the civil rights bill was removed from the floor. Senators who might have supported civil rights, seeing time running short at the end of a session, would become more amenable to dropping the civil rights bill. Only for this session, of course, they could rationalize. It could be brought back in the next session. A filibuster could be ended in only one of two ways. One was by a cloture vote to end debate and force a vote on the bill. That method would be difficult, very difficult. In 1963, 67 votes, two-thirds of the Senate, were necessary to cut off debate so that a bill could be voted on. Without such a vote, a bill could not be voted on, could not be passed, could not become law. In the history of the Senate, there had never been enough votes to end a civil rights filibuster by cloture. Since 1938 alone, there had been 11 such attempts, and every one had failed. And Johnson, in his brief time in the presidency, had already found there were still not enough votes for cloture. Or a filibuster could be ended if its sponsors voluntarily withdrew it from the floor, thereby surrendering by abandoning the bill and admitting defeat. And therefore, as the end of a session grew closer, as time grew short, it would be not merely individual senators, but the White House, with its vital major measures like the tax cut and education bills, not to mention the appropriations bills, still being held hostage, that would begin to feel pressure to obtain their release by withdrawing the civil rights bill. And Johnson recognized something else. Not only had the strategy already been implemented, it was already working. Even while Kennedy had been in Texas, the Southerners had been reinforcing their lines. One of the 8 unpassed appropriations bills, for example, was the measure that would fund the operating expenses of 3 departments, State, Justice, and Commerce. Sent to Capitol Hill by the White House, like the other appropriations measures early in the year, it had been passed by the House on June 18th. Then it had been referred to the Senate Appropriations Committee, which referred it in turn to a subcommittee chaired by John McClellan of Arkansas, which referred it in turn to a subcommittee of McClellan's subcommittee. The Department of Commerce and Certain Related Agencies Subcommittee of the Subcommittee on Departments of State, Justice, and Commerce, as this final subcommittee was familiarly known, which was chaired by Spessard L. Holland of Florida, but with McClellan as its dominant member. McClellan was a tough, very shrewd, subtle legislator. During Johnson's days as leader, a young staff member had once reported back to him on negotiations with McClellan that the staffer felt had gone well. "Unzip your fly and take a look," Johnson had told him. "There's nothing there." "McClellan," he said, "just cut it off. With a razor so sharp, you didn't even notice it." During the 5 months since June 18th, McClellan had never even hinted at any connection between the State Justice Commerce Appropriations Bill and the Civil Rights Bill. He had simply found a number of projects unrelated to either measure with which to occupy himself. High-profile projects. An investigation of a possible scandal in a Defense Department award of a contract for the TFX fighter plane. Televised hearings about the Mafia. Everybody could see how busy McClellan had been, a Washington columnist. One of the few who glimpsed the strategy was to note. Nobody could prove that he was holding up an appropriations bill deliberately to slow down the legislative process and thus jam up the civil rights bill and other legislation, like the tax cut bill, that he didn't fancy. But the subcommittee of the subcommittee had been too busy to hold even a single hearing on the bill. And when, on November 21st, an angry liberal, Joseph Clark of Pennsylvania, introduced a resolution on the Senate floor that would have taken the bill away from appropriations and brought it to the floor for debate, vote, and hopefully passage, the presiding officer had asked if there were any objections. And Richard Russell, sitting at his desk, had raised his arm and said calmly, "I object." The two words meant that a vote would have to be taken first, not on Clark's resolution, but on Clark's motion to bring the resolution to the floor. There could be a debate on that motion, and the debate could continue as long as Russell's Southern senators wanted it to continue. There could, in other words, be a filibuster against the motion to bring the resolution to the floor. And if the filibuster was by some chance ended and the resolution made it to the floor, there could be a debate on the resolution itself, and then a filibuster against any attempt to bring the debate to an end and actually vote on the bill. The State Justice Commerce Bill was just one of the 8 appropriations bills that had not yet been released and reported to the floor by the Senate Appropriations Committee, which, of course, would act only after the bills had been reported back to it by its subcommittees. The Appropriations Committee was dominated by Southerners and their allies, so each of the remaining bills was in the hands of a subcommittee dominated by the South, stacked deeply enough with Southerners and their allies to ensure that, in the unlikely event that a revolt should be mounted against a subcommittee chairman, it would have little chance of succeeding. And even if a bill was reported out by a subcommittee, it would still have to be voted on by the full 27-member committee, and the date of the vote would be whatever the committee's chairman, Carl Hayden of Arizona, staunch ally of the Southern Caucus, decided. The stalemate on Capitol Hill was unprecedented, the Congressional Quarterly said. A new continuing resolution had been proposed to provide funds until January 31st for the agencies affected. If it was approved, it will be the first time in memory that Congress has been forced to provide for such a blanket carryover, the Washington Post noted. The appropriations backlog had, in fact, resulted in another situation which not even the oldest congressional observers could recall. An administration was in the latter stages of drawing up the budget for the next fiscal year, in this case the budget that would cover the year beginning July 1, 1964, the budget about which the Troika had conferred with Johnson, while Congress had not yet passed bills to make funds available for the current fiscal year. Nevertheless, a continuing resolution seemed the only choice. Russell's troops weren't budging, and neither were Republican conservatives, as they were pleased with the results of the delay. The GOP's Munt, who sat on no fewer than 6 of the 12 Senate Appropriations subcommittees, said that since already too much money is being spent and spent too rapidly, I am perfectly content to let the appropriations bills wait until next March. And appropriations were just some of the bills that Congress had not sent on to the White House, and the list ran on beyond major measures like Kennedy's education bill. Bills before Russell's own Armed Services Committee had not moved at the anticipated pace. Some were not moving at all. Bills were not the only problem. Nominations had been made a part of the strategy. The hearings on Kennedy nominees, for example, were droning on endlessly. The most important hostage being held to stop the civil rights bill was, of course, the tax cut bill. Kennedy's pleas for passage of the tax legislation, now in its 11th month before Congress, had been reiterated shortly before his departure for Texas. This nation urgently needs its earliest possible passage, he had said on November 16th. Clearly, no single step can be more important as insurance against recession. This is a good bill and we need it now. In addition to Harry Byrd's other reasons for holding the tax bill in his finance committee, however, another reason was the civil rights bill. No one understood better than he the horrific consequences that would follow the enactment of such a bill. The Brown decision had been bad enough. When a federal judge had issued a ruling to enforce it in Byrd's native Virginia, the senator had pointed out the dangers. 6-year-old children of both races were going to be assembled in little huts before the bus comes, and the bus will then be packed like sardines, he said. And everyone knew what would come of that. What our people most fear is that by this close intimate contact, future generations will intermarry. Intermarriage, miscegenation, the mongrel race of which Dick Russell warned. Byrd had called for massive resistance by the white people of this country to all court rulings which might foster integration. And now there had come upon the South this new civil rights bill. He was ready to do his part to stop it. He hadn't let the fact that Kennedy's decision in June to send civil rights to Capitol Hill had played into the South's hands make its way into Washington or New York newspapers, but talking that June to a Richmond Times-Dispatch reporter who was an old friend, he let that fact slip, saying, as the reporter summarized his views, that the new civil rights legislation from President Kennedy would bring on a Senate filibuster that would probably delay hearings on the tax bill before the Senate Finance Committee. The tax bill hearings, in other words, would not be brought to an end. They would still be going on. The bill was not going to be freed from the Finance Committee until the Civil Rights Bill had been disposed of, either by being withdrawn or by being sufficiently weakened. That had been back in June. It was 5 months later now. The Civil Rights Bill hadn't been disposed of, and Byrd was still holding his endless hearings on the tax bill, implementing Russell's strategy of delaying administration bills in the Senate so that they would still be available as hostages against civil rights when the rights bill came over from the House. Kennedy had handed him a hostage, an extremely valuable hostage, and he was holding it fast. If the president wanted his tax cut bill, he was going to have to abandon or gut his civil rights bill. Other Southern Committee and subcommittee chairmen were doing their part, holding their own hostages. If you don't get your other bills under lock and key, Lyndon Johnson had warned, these other bills would be stalled. His advice had not been heeded, and the other bills were stalled. And not only had the Civil Rights Bill not yet reached the Senate, there was no indication of when it would. The first step in the Southern strategy of denying supporters of civil rights sufficient time to pass the bill in the Senate was to delay the moment at which the Senate could begin considering the bill, to delay, in other words, the time at which the bill came over from the House, to have Chairman Smith keep it bottled up in his House Rules Committee as long as possible. And Smith had already begun doing that. On November 21st, after a five-month-long battle in the House Judiciary Committee, the bill had finally been reported out, not to the House floor, but only to Smith's Rules Committee, since no bill can go to the House floor without an accompanying rule setting the length of debate and whether amendments to the bill can be offered. On the morning of November 22nd, at about the time Kennedy was speaking at the Chamber of Commerce breakfast in Fort Worth, House Speaker John McCormick was asking Smith when rules might take up and report out the bill so that the House could vote on it. Smith had said blandly that he didn't know. Not enough time remained to hold hearings before the Christmas recess, he said. The hearings would have to begin after Congress reconvened in January. Trying to bargain with him, McCormick said that if Smith would agree to hold hearings before the recess, he in return would agree not to call the bill up for floor action until after Congress reconvened. Smith wasn't interested in bargaining. He told the Speaker he wouldn't agree to anything. He refused even to say when in January the hearings would begin, or how long they might last after they had begun. He would discuss that matter with members of his committee, he said, but he wouldn't begin those discussions until after Congress reconvened. When, on November 29th, Johnson asked McCormick, "He won't give you a hearing of any kind before the recess?" McCormick's reply was a flat no. "He was frank about it," McCormick said. "He won't do anything to help the bill along." Asked about his plans for the bill by the Washington Post, Smith was equally frank. "No plans," he replied. "He would make plans in January," he said. Smith's statement to McCormick that he would not begin discussing the starting date and the duration of the Rules Committee hearings on the Civil Rights Bill until after Congress reconvened had ominous implications. If he had not agreed before the Christmas recess on a date for the beginning of the hearings, what would begin when Congress reconvened was not the hearings, but only the discussions with committee members, the negotiations between Smith and liberal committee members over the date. And if Smith had not agreed before the recess on a date by which the hearings would end, that date as well would have to be negotiated in January. Negotiations with Judge Smith could be lengthy negotiations. The hearings themselves might not begin until quite some time after Congress had reconvened. Understanding the strategy, Johnson explained it to people whose support he needed. "He, Smith, won't do one damned thing," he told Robert Anderson in a telephone call on November 30th. "His idea, of course, is that he'll run it, the civil rights hearings, over until January, and then in January they'll be late coming back, getting back to work after the recess, and he'll piddle along and get it into February, and then maybe they won't get it out of the full House until March. And then in March the Senate will be able to filibuster it until it goes home and there'll be nothing done." Understanding it, he explained what had to be done to defeat it. To, for example, break the Rules Committee impasse immediately before Christmas 1963, since otherwise there would be little hope of passing civil rights by July 1964. "We're going to have to do it now," he told Catherine Graham in another call. "If we don't, they're going to start quitting here about the 18th of December, and they'll come back about the 18th of January. Then they'll have hearings in the Rules Committee until about the middle of March. And then they'll pass the bill, and it will get over to the Senate, and Dick Russell will say it's Easter and Lincoln's birthday, and by the time he gets them, the Civil Rights Bill, he will screw them to death because he is so much smarter than they are." Understanding the strategy, Lyndon Johnson understood that it was working, both parts of it. The Southern tactics were designed to prevent any progress on the Civil Rights Bill until Congress reconvened in 1964, to keep the bill stalled during the 3 weeks remaining before the Christmas recess. And that's what the South was doing at both ends of the Capitol, and it was far from clear that progress would be made in January. On the main battlefield, the Senate, Byrd's refusal to accelerate his pace meant that his hearings might not resume until Congress got down to business in mid-January. The amendments to the tax bill would still be before his committee then, still to be debated and voted upon when the Civil Rights Bill arrived in the Senate. The tax bill would still be imprisoned in committee, still available as a hostage. And, of course, the Civil Rights Bill wasn't even in the Senate yet, and there was no schedule to get it there. Chairman Smith was refusing to even discuss the Rules Committee's hearings.